This is part one of the short series on free will, the two-part series, not to replace the five-part series that's already on the website. Free will, according to many philosophers, is the most difficult problem in all of philosophy. It has many ramifications, many connections, and that's true both in general philosophy and it's true in analyzing the place of free will in a religious thought system. There are many difficulties in both. This hour, I'm going to take you through a few of the religious problems with free will. And the next hour, we'll talk about some of the scientific and philosophical problems. But when I do this at a leisurely pace, it takes 4 or 5 weeks. And there's 5 hours of it on my website. So we're just skimming off the top to give you a little bit of the flavor of the problems and how they can be solved, and to partly clarify what free will is along the way. Because the situation is so bad that there isn't even a definition of the subject that people agree upon, what free will is. It would be lovely to start with the definition. This is what free will is, and then go on to discuss the problems. One of the problems is to define what it is. Well, let me start with a very simple, direct problem, assimilating free will within a religious context. Free will seems to mean I make my own choices. I chart my own path. I set my own priorities. I choose my own values. I live my own life. On the other hand, there are divine commandments, and it is clear that we are to fulfill those commandments. Doesn't the fact that God is commanding us what to do mean that we really don't have free will? I'm not setting my own path. I'm doing what he says. Doesn't divine commandments and the understanding that that is what we are to do contradict what's claimed when it said that we do have free will? Is there a contradiction here? No, of course not, because the Torah is true and it can't be contradictory. No, but there has to be a better reason than that. I mean, there has to be a philosophical reason. Yeah, why isn't it contradictory? You shook your head no.
Yeah, the free will is to choose the discipline.
Okay. The key point here is that free will, as we understand it, is a power. It's the power to act on your own. It means that what you do is not caused by some external power forcing you. Divine commandments are, now here I used a very ambiguous phraseology just to make the problem seem like it was a problem. Divine commandments are what we are to do. What does that mean? It means what we're supposed to do, what we should do, what we're obligated to do. The fact that I have obligations doesn't cancel my power to fulfill the obligations or to violate the obligations. Let's take some concrete cases. Soldiers in the army, and his commanding officer says, I command you to shut the door. Does the soldier have free will? Of course he does. He has the free will to disobey the order. Ask Israeli soldiers. In the Israeli army, an order is a recommendation. And the soldier decides, do I want to do that or don't I want to do that? The Golan Heights belongs to us because the soldiers on the field took it against direct orders. The command said, don't attack, and they said, baloney, we're taking it. And they took it. Anyway, so a command can be a valid command. The soldier can't invalidate the command, but he has the power to fulfill the command or not fulfill the command. Now let's push it a little harder. A puts a gun to B's head and says, do it or I'll kill you. Does B have free will?
Yes,
he does. Because B can always choose to die rather than obey. Indeed, through history, millions of people have chosen to die rather than obey. Yes, you might have some people who go into shock, who just, you know, their psychology collapses and they become robots. That could happen. But it doesn't have to happen. As I say, millions of cases, and not only religious cases. You have guerrillas or fighting a war, and one of them members are captured by the enemy, and they torture him and say, tell us where your Confederates are. And he says, no, I'd rather die than betray my Confederates. So an order or that kind of direct coercion does not take away a person's free will. Free will is the power to act. The power to act rightly or wrongly. The power to fulfill one's obligations or to violate one's obligations. It's a power, the fact that God gives commandments doesn't contradict that. If someone made a mistake, this is what I was trading on when I asked the question. If someone made a mistake and thought that free will is an authority to choose my own path, nothing outside of me can criticize my path, my choice of goals. My choice of goals is right for me because I chose it for me. There's no external standpoint from which I can be criticized. The choice is essentially personal and self-validating, self-verifying. Because I made it for me, it's right for me. If you thought that, then there could be a problem. Because when the Torah says to fulfill divine commandments, if someone chooses as a goal something which the Torah forbids, then the Torah's position is that he's made a wrong choice. He's made a bad choice. So if one thought that free will was an authority to make choices immune from criticism, then there really would be a contradiction between what one could call free will authority on the one hand and divine commandments on the other. But the Torah doesn't acknowledge any such authority. A person does not have a self-verifying, self-validating authority to choose his own goals. Everything is subject to the critique of the Torah. And therefore, from the Torah's point of view, it's not a contradiction that the Torah has to worry about. You with me so far? Let me briefly point out that the idea of free will authority, this self-validation of making your own choices of your own goals, doesn't make sense philosophically either. Although you hear it said a lot. Being a philosopher is very frustrating because you hear a lot of things said a lot, which you know are dead wrong. Imagine someone chooses X as his goal, something he's going to set himself to achieve. And we know that X is impossible to achieve. His goal is to square the circle, or trisect the angle, or to build a perpetual mobile, that is a machine that doesn't have a net loss of energy, or something like that. Can't we say, the poor fellow, he's wasting his time, he's wasting his effort, because he set himself to achieve a goal which we know is impossible. That's a wrong goal to choose. We know that and he doesn't, and we can criticize him. The fact that he's chosen it doesn't make it right for him. If you need the following as a proof, imagine that if we would tell him it's impossible, he would get rid of it right away. He's just chosen it because he thinks it's possible. He's ignorant of the fact that it's impossible. So then we know it's impossible, know that he's making a mistake. The fact that he's chosen it for himself doesn't mean that it's self-verifying in that way. Another case. Consider Peter and Paul. When the story starts, Peter's 13 and Paul's 8. And Paul says, when I grow up, I want to be a fireman. And Peter says, you know, we live on the same block and we go into the same schools. I also wanted to be a fireman when I was 8. But I'm 13. I'm telling you, you'll outgrow it. And Paul says, get off my back. Let me live my own life. I'm an American, after all. You know, don't tell me what to do. I'm going to be a fireman. And when he's 13, he's given it up. Now he wants to be president of the United States. And Peter says, now being 18, listen, Paul, I also was 13. And we were going to the same schools, living in the same neighborhood. And I'm telling you, I also wanted to be president at 13. But I'm 18 now. You'll outgrow it. And Paul, with his American chip on his shoulder, says, give me a break. Don't tell me what to do. Let me live my own life. By the time he's 18, he's outgrown it. Now Peter's 23. Paul now wants to find a cure for cancer. And Peter says, yeah, I was there. I was there. I know we went to the same science high school together, you know, and I picked up those ambitions as well. But now I'm 23 and I finished college. I'm telling you, you'll see more realistically when you're 23 and you'll give it up. And when he's 23, by golly, he gives it up. Now imagine two or three more rounds like this. Now we come to the age of 38 and 43. And Paul says, 38 years old, he says, I want to win the Nobel Prize in Mathematics. To become a mathematician. And Peter says, I've been there. I took the same college courses you did, and I entered the industry the same way that you did, and I'm 5 years down the road, and I'm telling you 5 years from now you won't want it. At this point, couldn't Paul reflect on his experience and say, Peter sure knows me well. He's made 6 predictions, and they were all true. So, why don't I skip 5 years of wasted effort and take it from him that this is a wrong choice for me? Couldn't Paul learn that Peter knows him better than he knows himself and use that information to change his choice of goals? We certainly don't want to say that because Paul chose it for himself, it's self-verifying, self-validating, it's automatically right for him, if we have very good reason, and he has very good reason to think he's going to change his mind in a few years. So I think that the idea that your choices are self-verifying, self-validating for yourself is just a very naive idea. By the way, the first argument for impossibility was made by Thomas Nagel, one of the very best contemporary philosophers. So the idea of free will as an authority is simply unsupportable philosophically, and the idea of free will as a power is perfectly all right for us. We have the power to obey and the power to disobey. You with me so far? Now suppose someone says, we have the power to obey and disobey, but the Torah promises us vast reward for obedience and threatens us with terrible punishment for disobedience. Surely a person who really believes that, who really believes in reward and punishment, won't have free will. The promise of the reward and the threat of punishment will simply overwhelm his psychology, and he will do what's right, like a robot. How's that sound? Yeah.
Hopeful.
So speaks someone who's already got both feet inside. Other people would say it's not frightening. If I really believe that, you know, I'd become a robot. This comment, several years from now, you'll find to be very, very important. Very, very important. But it's not going to insert into the discussion at this point. Yeah.
It doesn't really ring true to what I understand about reinforcement in this lifetime, religiously, because we don't. There's not a one-to-one correspondence or an understandable or clear one-to-one reinforcement between what we do and how we're rewarded. It's easy to slip back.
But by one-to-one reinforcement, you mean present, immediate reinforcement. Because the promise of reward is one-to-one. The promise of reward is one-to-one and commensurate in detail. That's the promise.
Yeah, but like with Pavlov's dog, it's very clear to see the behavior and behavior, or rather, sorry, condition stimulus and reinforcement. Yeah. Or with Skinner's pigeons, it's right. Clear to see, you know, behavior and then reinforcement. But for us, it's not clear. The connection isn't easy to see. If we could see it, we would be much better off.
Okay, so I think that's right. That's one very important point here, that something which is promised in the future and you don't experience directly doesn't have that kind of impact on your psychology.
Right.
There are people who smoke. Some of them, maybe only 1%, are still rational. And they do understand that they are shortening their lives.
Right.
And they do understand that when they get there, they're going to regret smoking, but it's not now. It's 30 years from now. And therefore, it doesn't have the effect of stopping their smoking at the present time. I think that's right. And I think, in addition to what you say, which I think is perfectly correct, our psychology is even weaker than that. A person can do something now, knowing that right now he's suffering by it. And he can see that he's suffering by it and still not take the appropriate action. Take people who are shy. They're standing in a social gathering, and they know if they walk over to another person, stick out their hands, and say, hello, I'm so-and-so, who are you? They'll have a good time. And they stand there with their feet rooted to the spot, and they don't do what will give them pleasure right now. Or how about tomorrow, when students, I'm not talking to anyone here, of course, but there are students who don't study for the exam, you know. And then when they walk into the exam and see the question, say, oh, last night, why did I watch the television? You know, why didn't I study? Right? Got one back there. You betting it? That's nice. In my years teaching university, I met quite a few. There the person knows in 12 hours he's going to be sorry. And he knows it repeatedly because it happens exam after exam after exam. And yet it doesn't make him into a robot to do what he knows is right for him. There's a deep point here which has lots of applications. What you know does not automatically control what you do. There's a gap between the head and the heart. And there's a certain set of techniques in Jewish practice designed to bridge that gap, to take what you know clearly and enable you to put it into practice in spite of the blockage of the heart. And if you have studied philosophy, or you will, you'll recognize that this issue was taken up by Plato and Aristotle. Plato thought that in some sense or other, knowledge was virtue, and Aristotle said there's such a thing as weakness of the will. You can know clearly what's right and still not do it. And that means that Aristotle got it right, and Plato got it wrong. Okay, so the knowledge that I'm going to be rewarded and punished does not take away my free will. Now let's talk about something a little deeper. What about predestination? Fate or predestination? God set up the world. He has a plan for the world. He wants it to develop in a certain way to a certain end. And he laid out the plan and set up how it's supposed to develop. If that plan includes in detail human actions, then it seems that those human actions are not free. Because God, with the power and control of a creator, made the world so that it will develop that way. This is what's called fate. Maybe the most vivid exposition of fate is in the myth of Oedipus. Oedipus is fated to marry his mother and kill his father. And he finds out about this. And he's horrified, and he runs hundreds of miles from home. Too bad, Oedipus. It's fate. You can't escape fate. So what happens? He's driving his chariot down a narrow passageway, way, and another chariot comes the opposite direction, and there's an altercation between him and the other chariot driver, and Oedipus kills him. It turns out to be his father. And there's a city-state that's under siege, and Oedipus comes in with his clever strategy, saves the city, and as a reward they allow him to marry the queen, who's his mother. What do you think would happen if, upon hearing this horrible fate, Oedipus decides to jump off a cliff? Okay, so some of my students say that he'll land on his father. But as you say, he can't die because it's fated that these things must happen. Fate means you can't get out of it. No matter what you try, no matter how you twist and turn, it's got to happen. Under those conditions, you don't have free will. Fate, predestination, the crucial syllable there is pre. Predestination, predetermination does contradict free will. But it's not a problem for us because the Torah does not believe in predestination, predetermination, or fate. There are religions that do, but we don't. Adam and Eve in the garden could have chosen correctly. Had they chosen correctly, the whole of human history would never have happened, which means that none of it was fated. King Chizkiyahu, towards the end of the first temple period, could have been the Messiah. He made a mistake. Had he done it right, he would have been the Messiah. The last 2,500 years of history would not have taken place. So the idea of predestination, that things are fixed from the beginning that have to happen, including human actions, is simply an idea that we reject. And when you hear statements from the tradition that sound like predestination, you have to know that the way they sound is not the way they are. For example, we are told that 40 days before the fetus is formed in the womb, a heavenly voice proclaims that so-and-so will marry so-and-so. Now you say, that's a heavenly voice. That's got to be fixed. And if it's fixed before I'm even formed in the womb, so then, now let's see. I remember getting married. There was a period of experimentation. Sometimes I said no, sometimes she said no, until both of us said yes. At least it felt like I was exercising free will, at least the times that I said no. The times that she said no, it was her free will, I guess. Until I said yes and she said yes. Does this statement in the Talmud mean that's all an illusion? It was really fixed from before and I wasn't exercising free will? The answer is no. The voice from heaven could turn out to be wrong. The voice from heaven only proclaims what is normally expected, what will happen if nothing unusual intervenes. But such statements are not meant as absolute. As Tosfos says several places in Shas, in related connections, the voice proclaims before the person is formed in the womb that so-and-so will marry so-and-so. Do these people have free will to commit suicide? Yes, they do. And if they commit suicide, they're not going to marry. Right? So the voice from heaven is not absolute. And so it is with all the statements that you find in the tradition that say such and such will happen. They are not absolute. They are simply norms set up to operate under the vast majority of ordinary conditions, but if the conditions are changed, then they do not operate. Any question?
Was there any documented cases where the voice from heaven said one thing and it didn't happen?
Sure. There is a case in the Talmud where someone was supposed to marry someone and one of them made a bad choice and he lost out. And there are many cases where the commentators point out how such things could take place. The judgment on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, what's going to happen in the following year, says the Ramban, could be undone by a later choice. The decree that you'll have so and so much money in the coming year, what happens if on the third day of the year the person commits suicide? Does that mean as he's dying someone will run up with a check and put it in his hand, you know, $45,000 because the decree was? No, it doesn't mean that. It means under normal conditions, that's what you can expect to happen, but the conditions don't have to be normal. Yeah?
Yes, that sort of reminds me of Shakespearean webs of deceit.
Yeah, okay. Okay.
So, I mean, like in a web of deceit, you would have the weaver, so to speak, who has like a really good understanding of people's characters, and the choices that they will probably make when confronted with certain environmental cues.
But the key is probably. The key word there is probably, and that's the key. That's the point. Good. Very good. Yeah.
Do we not have several predetermined spouses?
Say again.
Do we not have several predetermined spouses?
Well, and this is really quite. We have to be quite careful here. Could have meaning. If I were inventing my own religion, sure. But you're talking about the Jewish religion, then I have only the source that the tradition gives me. And there it says so-and-so will marry so-and-so, name by name. It doesn't say so-and-so will marry this batch.
Is that secondary and third and fourth?
That's another thing. That not that the voice proclaims, but your point is very well taken. Isn't it true that quite a number of people have more than one marriage in their lifetimes? So there has to be more than one person that a person can marry. Now that one could answer is after the first one, right? After the first one that the voice proclaimed. But it can't be limited to the one the voice proclaims, absolutely, because as you say, people do have multiple marriages. That's quite correct. Yeah.
I think they wanted to be first that they just made a few mistakes until they got the right person that they were supposed to marry. But they had the free choice to marry people, and that Latin fourth person they married was the real person that they were set up with.
Right.
Also, I'm interested in going to prove the fact that the voice and I was right, their husband would never get married.
Okay, alright. One might squeeze out and say maybe the voice doesn't proclaim every time. But even so, our sources tell us that it doesn't have to happen. Okay, I do want to get to foreknowledge and free will, yeah.
So regarding predestiny, what about the idea like when you want something you try really hard to go for it, but then the outcome of it, like you shouldn't really worry about it so much because the outcome is ultimately like predetermined?
It's a mistake. It's a mistake. It's not the outcome is predetermined. It's that whether or not you get it is determined by God's deciding to give it to you. But like we said yesterday, one thing God may take into account when he decides to give it to you is how hard you tried. Now, if he takes that into account, it means it wasn't predetermined. It wasn't predetermined. It depended upon what you do. What was predetermined is this much effort gets this result and that much effort gets that result. But which result isn't predetermined? Because God's will for the situation is that it should depend upon your effort. Right? That's why I said the key syllable there is pre. We believe that God controls the world, but he controls it taking your decision into account. So your decision is one of the factors. That's not predetermined. Predetermined would mean independent of your decision, moving the difference what you decide. Yeah. That's the next question. But see, there's a big difference now. I'm talking about God's making it happen. You're talking about God's knowing the future. Those two problems are entirely distinct. God could make things happen knowing nothing. Just make it happen. And God could know what's going to happen without doing anything. be a passive observer, just knowing the future. These two problems are completely independent of one another.
Even that he knows that it's going to happen.
Well, one, no, it just means that nothing else can happen. It doesn't mean fated in the sense that he's forced it to happen. Well, I'm coming to that problem next. Yeah. Okay, yeah.
So if we go back to Adam and Eve.
Yeah.
God is kind, the ultimate kindness. And the greatest gift he can give us is to earn reward.
Okay.
So we work for it, because otherwise we'll feel embarrassed if he just gives it to us.
Yeah.
So why then was this world, where we earn reward, only a second plan and not his first plan?
Oh no, it's the first plan. The Garden of Eden was this world in which we earn the reward. That free choice in the Garden of Eden was the earning of the reward.
So it wasn't a sin that they committed when Adam and Eve ate from it?
Of course it was. Earning the reward would have meant not eating from it. The world of the Garden of Eden is the world in which you earn the reward. Had they chosen correctly there, by making that free, correct choice, they would have earned the reward.
Okay.
Having made the wrong choice, they have to do more. We have to do more to earn the reward.
But where would we have all come into the world if they hadn't eaten?
Okay, it's an interesting question, but it doesn't bear on my problem of free will. Ramchal talks about that. In the way of God, he talks about that. Okay, let's go to foreknowledge and free will, because otherwise we're not going to be able to do even that. Here's the problem which everybody worries about. He's asked it twice already, today and yesterday. If God already knew yesterday what I'm going to do today, how can I have free will to make my own decision today? Now, first of all, we have to state the problem correctly. It took philosophy decades and decades to get the right formulations in the 20th century. It was finally achieved by a fellow named Nelson Pike in an article in the Philosophical Review in 1965. Actually, the Rambam had the correct formulation 850 years before, but then you can't expect Nelson Pike to read the Rambam. Right? So that would be an unfair expectation. Here's how the problem should be set up. I'm making a decision between A and B. And at least it seems to me, both are open to me, both are possible. I consider up until the time of the decision, which shall I do? And then I choose A. Now let's reflect. Already yesterday, God knew that I was going to choose A. Could I have chosen B? What would choosing B mean? If God's knowledge that I'm going to choose A is already on record, choosing B would mean to contradict God's knowledge. Surely you can't contradict God's knowledge. Once again, a little more. Is it possible for me to choose B?
No.
Yes, God would have known.
Ah, oh, that's a solution. Oh, good. That's a solution. But let's understand the problem. The problem is, if you say it's possible for me to choose B, then it's possible for God's knowledge yesterday to be wrong. But if God's knowledge is infallible, if it's impossible to be wrong, then I don't even have the possibility of choosing B. Because the possibility of choosing B means the possibility that his knowledge yesterday that I was going to do A would be wrong. And there is no such possibility. So if we picture God yesterday knowing that I'm going to choose A, it seems like I can't choose B. The problem with foreknowledge is that it cuts off the alternative. It's important to focus on that as the problem. It's not that God's knowledge forces me to choose A. There's no way for God's knowledge to do that. God's knowledge is outside my system. It's a fact about Him. But it means I have no alternative. And the way we normally understand free will is a choice between alternatives which are possible. If I have no possible alternatives, then it seems like I'm not making a choice. That's the right way to define the problem. Now, there are four solutions here.
So basically, you're saying if God has foreknowledge, He knows the choice you're going to make.
That's right.
But you're still making a choice. But He knows you well enough to know what you'll do. Oh, no.
No, no. He knows the future. Not that He knows my character now and can predict what will a person like that do under these circumstances. No, we're talking about knowing the future directly. And that being the case, it seems that it's not possible for me to do B. Because the possibility of doing B would mean the possibility that His knowledge I'm going to do A is false. And that means His knowledge is fallible. And that's not true about God's knowledge. Yeah.
Knowledge and control are separate concepts.
Correct. I'm not talking about control or activity now. I'm talking just about knowledge. But it's bad enough, right? Imagine the timeline of the world, right? And you come to yesterday, and in that picture of yesterday, you have God's knowledge, I will do A. Now the world continues, Now I come to today, can I put in a fact here that I do B? Won't it contradict the fact that's there in yesterday? Yesterday says, I will, yeah, he knows I'm going to do A, and now I do B. That world in which he knew yesterday A, and I do B, is a world with a contradiction. It contradicts his knowledge. If his knowledge is infallible, the world can't continue on to B. Its mere possibility of continuing on to B means it's possible that his knowledge of that A is false. And if his knowledge is infallible, as it should be, then, indeed, it can't continue on to B. So B is not really an alternative. Yeah. Okay, now let's talk about solutions. I'm going to give you two. There are four, at least four. I'm going to give you two, which I hope are the easiest ones to explain. We have a contradiction between God's knowledge, foreknowledge, and our free will. Suppose we just give up God's knowledge. Give it up. We won't say that God knows. Then there's no problem, right? Sure, there's no problem, but then you've lost God. I mean, surely God knows, right? Isn't that part of the definition of God? Okay, time for a big surprise. According to both the philosophical sources in our tradition and the Kabbalistic sources in our tradition, we can't describe God at all. We can't conceive of God. We can't understand God. Our concepts don't apply to God. God is beyond all thought, beyond all understanding, beyond all conceptualization. This is what's meant by calling him infinite. Some of you probably know that in mathematics we treat infinity nowadays very easily, since Cantor's work in the 1880s. Infinite doesn't mean mathematically. Infinite means beyond all description, beyond all limitation, beyond all conceptualization. And therefore, we simply shouldn't say that God knows. God knows is a positive description. If you need a little bit of intuition, you can see it this way. All of our concepts are human concepts. When we say knows, what do we mean? We mean the knowledge we're familiar with, the knowledge that we have of ourselves, we judge that other people have. That's certainly not true of God. Whatever he is, he doesn't do things the way we do it. And that's true for all descriptions. Nothing we say about God can be true of God. Maimonides in the Guide goes so far as to say we can't even say that God exists. Because when you say exists, what do you have in mind? Well, tables and puffs of smoke and concepts and numbers and properties. God isn't like any of those. And his existence isn't like any of those. So from our world, we take our concept of existence. That concept indeed does not apply to God. Okay, but then what about all the descriptions of God? I mean, the Tanakh, the Bible, has hundreds, and the Talmud and the Midrash, the Siddur, the prayer book. Don't we have hundreds and hundreds of descriptions of God? Now, here's the trick. They're not descriptions of what God is. They're descriptions of what God does. And everything that looks like a description of what God is has to be translated into a description of what God does. So, we say God is just. We're not describing God's inner character. What we mean is, eventually, right actions get rewarded and wrong actions get compensated somehow, which is commensurate with their wrongness. We say that God loves the Jewish people. What we mean is, eventually things will work out. The Jewish people will have a special place in the world. We're talking about how things work out, how things happen. We're not talking about what he is, only about what he does. And if that sounds rather suspicious to you, let me remind you that we have been in that situation in the natural world many times and still are in some respects. They asked someone 200 years ago what he knows about light. And I say, well, there are lots and lots of bodies that make light, fire and the stars and the sun and the moon, and phosphorescent rocks and so forth, glowing metal, right? And light. It can be reflected by mirrors and can be refracted by prisms, and knows quite a bit about light. Now I ask him, so what is it? What is it made of? Why does it work that way? 200 years ago? They didn't have a clue, or rather they had some clues that were definitely wrong. I mean, Descartes had the corpuscular theory, and then Thomas Young's experiments with the prisms showed him that can't be right. Even today, they fancifully call it a wavicle, as if they understood it, which they don't. And the better scientists agree that they don't. So we know what it does. We know how to manipulate it. But we don't know what it is. Certainly didn't know what it was until the 20th century. And many would say we don't even today. So the idea that we can know what something does without knowing what it is not a foreign idea. We've been in that situation many times in the history of science, and some will say we're still in that situation. And we're saying a similar thing about God. All the descriptions are descriptions of things that he does, not what he is. Now, to make the problem work, to make the contradiction work, I need to know what he is. I need to know that he has knowledge. That's what makes the contradiction with free will. If I don't have that statement on record, that he has the knowledge, the problem goes away. Let me just finish it, and then I'll take your question. Well then, but what are we going to do with the statement of his omniscience? If we can't take it literally, and we've got to translate it into a statement about what he does, what will it say? And by the way, Luzzatto says in one of his works that the descriptions of God really are descriptions of what he does, and he gives a list, and he explicitly says one of them is God's knowledge. That's Luzzatto, who represented the Kabbalistic tradition and did so in a philosophical way. So I have a direct source for this particular case. What does it mean in terms of action? Here's the way you do it. Here's the principle. When a statement says God is X, you make the following moves. First of all, pretend that God really were X. That's only a pretense. We'll take it away in a minute. But just pretend. Then ask yourself, if God really were X, what would he do? Say, oh, well, if God were X, then he'd do A, B, and C. That's step two. Now step three, subtract X and leave A, B, and C. And simply say, then A, B, and C is what's going to happen. That's what I did with justice. Pretend God were just. If he were just, what would he do? Well, he'd reward good actions and he would take care of evil actions in an appropriate way. Okay, now subtract God's being just and say that, and merely say that good actions will be rewarded and bad actions will be taken care of in an appropriate way. So you end up with only a description of what's going to happen, and you subtract the description of God, so to speak. What about knowledge? What will it mean to say that God is omniscient? Let's go through the same method. If God were omniscient, what would he do? In what way would omniscience play a role in his decisions and his actions? Well, he'd make sure that everything that happens is perfectly coordinated with everything else that happens. What do you do with knowledge when you make a choice? You think these things happen, this is the situation now, these are the effects on the future, and you choose your action to be best in terms of his relationships to everything else. So if God really were omniscient, then what he does would be perfectly coordinated with the past, present, and future. Now just subtract omniscience and say, what happens in the world is perfectly coordinated with the past, present, and future. Right? That's how you get a description of the world and what happens in it, and you don't have a description of God. And that being the case, you have no problem of contradiction because we're no longer saying that God knows the future. Okay. Someone a question over here? No. Yeah.
I just have a problem with the phrase he, because not only does it make God limit him in terms of gender, but also is it possible to make he into a description in terms of an action, in terms of what he does, he. There's no way of
it. Well, quite right. So now I'll say what happens other than human free choice. And given what we said yesterday about free choice, you could even put it in, that is to say, what the body does is included in what happens. The only thing that's not included under the description is human free choices, which come from us. So I can do it negatively, just by describing the field without talking about a he that's doing it.
But I'm saying the Torah always refers to he.
Oh, and it refers to his arms and his legs and his eyes, right? And all of that has to be re-understood as descriptions of action, descriptions of events.
Let's just say he himself. So, make that as a description of action.
It refers to the events that take place other than human free will. He does means this is one of the events brought about other than by human free will.
Just the word he, though, not he does, just he. It's a description, but yet it's impossible to.
Oh, well, that doesn't have to be. This was the objection they made to Descartes when he said, I think, therefore I am. What about it's raining? What's the it? Don't be silly. There's no it. It's not that an it is doing the raining. It's raining is a way of talking about saying that there's rain falling. The it isn't serious. Not every time you have a subject is the subject serious in the sentence, in the meaning of the sentence. The average taxpayer pays $6,000 a year. And where does he live, pray take this average taxpayer? And how much does he weigh? And what movies does he like? The average taxpayer. There is no such thing as the average taxpayer. There's just a way of saying that I summed them all up and divided by the number of taxpayers. Right? Not every time you have a subject of a sentence does it really talk about an actual subject that it's describing. Right?
That could be a problem, because then how do we know all the time that it says he and the Torah is referring to God? If your logic is true, how do you?
I don't see what the problem is. When you say the average taxpayer, that's not referring to the squirrel in your tree, right? It's not that because it isn't referring to a flesh and blood person, it's free game to say what you like. The average taxpayer isn't a marshmallow, right? When you say the average taxpayer, you understand by the meaning of the words that it's a way of summing up a lot of facts about how people pay taxes. Right? It doesn't mean that it's a blank, but it also doesn't mean that it's a serious subject. Say it's raining, it doesn't mean that the animals from the circus have gotten loose. It's raining means rain is falling, and the it there is just a placeholder for the rain falling.
No, it is. Seriously.
Okay, back to work. Another solution is this. Why do we think we have a problem? We think we have a problem because, as I said before, we think of a timeline. We come to yesterday. And planted in yesterday is God's knowledge that I will choose A. Now we imagine the timeline going on to today. And here I am faced with A and B. And we ask, since God's knowledge of A is in there yesterday, can it go on to have choice of B? That certainly sounds like a contradiction. So once A is in the timeline yesterday, it can't go on to contain B. But now, when I mentioned the problem, several people yelled out, including him, that this problem is based on a false supposition. You could argue it's based on a false supposition. Who says that the fact yesterday of choosing A is there independent of the choice? Who says it got there without an impact of the choice, that it's totally independent? What you said is actually the words of the Rav Sadi Gaon and the Keres Yitzchak. Had I chosen B, then yesterday there would have been the knowledge of B. It's true, you can't have knowledge of A continuing to be. But the question is, which causes which? Suppose that it's my choice today of A that causes God's knowledge yesterday of A. Actually, surprisingly enough, the person who got this right in independent of the Jewish tradition was Bertrand Russell. Bertrand Russell said, if you're trying to fight with religious people, and he fought with them his whole life, he was the famous atheist, he said, don't use this problem, because the idea of God's foreknowledge and free will can be solved very easily. Imagine, he said, that yesterday God gets a sneak peek at the future, a sneak preview. He looks ahead into the future and sees that I choose A. So it's my choice of A that causes him yesterday to know that I choose A. Now, an effect puts no limitations on its cause. Effect is downstream, so to speak, causally. So you can't say because that was the effect, therefore I didn't have choices in the cause. I wonder, can something I do today cause an effect yesterday? Isn't that out of order? I mean, I don't mean legally out of order. I mean, out of chronological. Doesn't the cause come first and the effect come second? So I have two things to tell you. Number one, philosophy has been trying to prove for over 200 years that the cause must come before the effect, and has come up empty-handed. No one has produced an argument that people accept that the cause must come before the effect. That's a fact, but it's not very important. Philosophy just isn't all that strong to prove anything. But in physics, in particle physics, there are events that are described standardly as the effect coming before the cause. Richard Feynman, who had the Nobel Prize in Physics, so I guess he wasn't dumb, in his book QED, that stands for quantum electrodynamics, has cases of particle interactions where the effect comes before the cause. And John Wheeler, another one of these revolving geniuses, asks the following question. Every electron is exactly the same as every other electron. Why is that? Beetles aren't all the same. Marshmallows aren't all the same. Leaves aren't all the same. Stars aren't all the same. How come every electron is identical to every other electron? It's very boring. How about a little variety? They're all exactly the same. And he proposed a very ingenious solution. He said there's really only one electron. There's only one electron in the entire universe. But you see, this electron has a very ambitious career. What it does is this. Right now, it's here. Then it moves forward in time and drifts a little bit. Then it goes backwards in time to our present moment over here. Then it goes forwards in time a little bit, and then it drifts backwards in time to our moment over here. It has a zigzag career in time, so that, going back and forth enough times, at our moment, it fills all those spaces, and it's always the same electron. And that's why they're all the same, because it's only one. But then, if I ask, why is it here? The answer is, well, it will be there, and then it drifts back to here. So the effect comes before the cause. So the idea of effects coming before causes is, surprise, surprise, accepted in contemporary physics. Now listen carefully. I don't pledge allegiance to any scientific theory. But I will say this. If contemporary physics says it does happen, we're allowed to conclude at least that it can happen. No one can say it's impossible and the physicists are making some silly, stupid mistake and they've overlooked some argument that anybody can think up, you know, over the third beer at 1:30 in the morning. That's not going to be true in physics. It might be true in astronomy, but it's not true in physics. And that being the case, we who say, according to the second solution, that my decision today causes God's knowledge yesterday, we're in perfectly good company. And that's a second way to solve the problem. Yeah.
Are all moments occurring simultaneously?
No. That would be a self-contradictory statement. For two moments to be different, they can't be simultaneous.
So if in the present, God has the opportunity to peer forwards into the future, while he's doing that, yeah. I'm experiencing this moment.
You are, that's right.
So at this moment, I am at the same time making future decisions.
Are you God now?
No, but God sees me making a decision in the future.
No, he sees the future. So since you're at this moment, then... And later stage of you is there, but what's here is, I mean, if you live 10 years, then you're in all of those years, right? That doesn't make all those years simultaneous. So we talk about stages of you. What's at this moment is your 22-year-old stage. And 10 years later is your 32-year-old stage.
Basically, I got two more questions. Is time
travel
possible?
There's a lot of literature on that subject. You mean... To the past.
According to the Torah.
Wait, one second. You mean to the past?
To the past, yeah.
Right, okay. So there's a lot of talk about that. Brian Greene in his Fabric of the Universe talks about it, and others do. There are many proposals, actually, by... You know, when I was a kid, I used to read science fiction. Now when I read science, it's just about the same thing. There are serious scientists who are proposing schemes for time travel. For particles and things like that, it's not clear that there's any problem with it. The old problem was that you could go back and shoot your grandfather and in that way guarantee that you don't exist. And Brian Greene, in his book, has a nice discussion of that, even though he's a physicist, it's pretty good philosophy. And what he points out briefly is that the past is what it is. I can't do this adequately. I'll just say some things and you can think about them or you can trap me some other time and I'll explain them to you. Can you change the future?
Yes, sure.
Oh, no, you cannot.
You're making it.
Correct. Good for you. You cannot change the future. If the future is going to be X, then it is going to be X. If it is going to be X, it means you're not changing it. Mm-hmm. You can't change the future any more than you can change the past. The difference between future and past is not changing. You can't change either of them. The difference is that you can make the future, whereas we think you can't make the past. What I do now can cause the future to be what it will be. And what I do now can't cause the past to be what it will be. That's what we think. What we're discovering now is that that's not correct either, at least in some cases. That what I do now can cause the past to be what it was. Can't change it from what it was. Either the thing happened at that time or it didn't happen at that time. You can't say, well, it didn't happen, and then I did this, and then it did happen. Because then you haven't got a consistent description of what actually happened at that time. That's why you can't change something. Change always means it was like this and it became like that. If you're talking about an event that took place at one time, change is nonsensical. Okay? So what we're talking about here is my action causes God's knowledge, the knowledge that he always had, but it's derived from my action. If it's derived from my action, then it can't put limitations on my action. Someone mentioned that God's outside of time. That's a third solution. There's another solution based on the work of Harry Frankfurt. There are plenty of solutions to this problem, and therefore it is a problem over which we don't lose much sleep. Yeah.
Heard someone speak though, they say that the time knows what choice you'll make. It's sort of like a family tree working in reverse. Where it's like you, and then you have two choices. Whatever choice it is, God knows what would happen if you chose that choice, and that choice, and then on, and so on. And then he'll know, so he doesn't know which choice to take, but he knows if you took that choice, which choice would come from that, and so on and so forth.
Right. Yeah, this is a common thought, but of course, as you put it correctly, it means there are facts he doesn't know. And our concept of omniscience won't allow that. It's a solution, but a solution by not accepting omniscience, yeah.
So, the statement, Yimach Shmo, right, that basically his name will be erased, that means that all recollection, because essentially in history, if it's not recorded, didn't happen. Is that what it's saying?
Yimach Shemo is a wish. It's not a prediction. It's a wish. It's a wish that his name not be recorded. But it may not be fulfilled. Well, you're treating it as a statement of what will be. I'm telling you.
Let's say it is fulfilled. Then,
okay.
Then what does it mean? It means that because that person did exist before, but as long as people don't know about him existing, then he didn't exist.
Not at all. It means that his existence has been forgotten. Ask a biologist. Where exactly on the Earth's surface did the first cell come into existence? He believes there's got to be such a place because there was a first cell. He believes in evolution, right? Okay. But where did it happen? No one knows. Does that mean it didn't happen? Does that mean there isn't such a place? Of course there is such a place and it did happen. He'll tell you. We just don't know where it is. The fact that you lose the knowledge of something doesn't mean it didn't exist. It means you don't know about how it existed. It doesn't wipe out its existence in the past. Right? No reason for that. Okay, I think we're going to have a discussion.